This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thanks.
Okay, can I just say something? We have a conversation, yeah. But I'm not going to look at you. I look at them.
Do it.
Okay, yeah. That's it.
You're in charge, Marina. I think we all know you're in charge. Okay, one question I want to ask the House is how many people went to 512 hours in the House?
No.
So quite a vast majority. Wonderful. Okay, well, I think then it makes most sense to start the conversation with that, Marina. And the first question has got to be, how are you feeling?
This is beside the point. Who cares? It's much more important what we achieved with that, I think. What is the second question?
That's not what you said backstage, by the way. Oh, Will, I'm knackered. The second question is why? Why that idea, and why that idea for London?
All right, so I think it's really wonderful that so many people here been in 512 hours, because as we know, we didn't talk there, and everybody had headphones to block the sound. So somehow I feel I own you so many, you know, explanations and what, how this idea came from and why. And it's a really long process. It's very interesting now that I hope everybody can come. I am here also in London, not just for this talk, but also because I'm opening the show in Listen Gallery, which is opening on 16, the September, just now. And in this show, it's interesting how it's created, because they really felt the people, there was the Klaus Rogenberg and the Sidney Russell and with Nicholas Logsdal in collaboration, that it's very important to show my early work, the something which from 69 to 75, before I left Yugoslavia, before everything had happened, that already in these early works, I have a kind of glimpse and the line which brings me to the Serpentine Gallery. Even at that time, you know, in the young artist, you're doing things intuitively and you don't even know why you're doing it, but you have this sort of strange and very strong urge of doing it. And there already I had this need to do something called freeing the horizon, freeing the space, freeing the memory, freeing the body, freeing everything, you know, and just get into the white space. And this Listen Gallery show is called The White Space. And if you see the Serpentine, is direct link to that. And then comes all the, you know, the series of my life and the performances, which was really interesting in reduction. How you can create performance from the less elements as possible. Of course, when you're young, you need props, you need this, you need that, you need some kind of support material to cover your insecurity. But then, the more you start understanding the potential energy every human being has himself, that actually you don't need anything. You just, magic happened with nothing, just from being there, and just radiating that energy itself. And you know, I've done very similar work, but again, very different in Artist is Present, when I just observe people, you know, in the front of me. But that work physically was very demanding and very difficult because I didn't move for a very long period of time. So my legs were swallowing, my body was not functioning, and physically was hell. But here, but maximum amount of people I could look at the day was maybe 12, because they say 5, 6, you know, 3, 4 hours, so I didn't look more. But here we have sometimes 1,200, 900, 700 people per day, which I'm interacting as much as I can. And this was incredible emotional, you know, the investment and demanding. And it was like you're really entering in some kind of parallel reality, which is nothing to do with the normal life. That performance become actually the life itself, because by 512 hours, I didn't walk on the streets of London. I just been in the Serpentine and in my flat and back to Serpentine.
Marina,
that was it.
Did during those 512 hours? I was staggered when I went in. I went in three or four times during the course of the exhibition. I was just staggered, as far as I could see, that everybody complied. Everybody, I suppose, you could put it very positively, and sort of joined in the spirit of what you were trying to do. That people were slow walking. People were in the middle, looking up. In this central zone, and then people were in the beds. Did anybody, or did you encounter many people who were uninterested and unbelieving and unwilling to connect with you?
But I think the process was very slowly. In the beginning, everybody was very shy and didn't understand what the hell is happening here. But somehow word of mouth and the people coming back create this kind of energy support. So the people, there was people coming almost every day. And then, you know, they become actually the part of the old piece. And they will instruct or talk to tell the story to the others. So everything becomes so smooth and incredibly, how you call it, the organic. So, you know, the last month was incredible. Everybody knew the moment he arrived what to do. I almost felt I was not needed. So that I start doing these things, that I become one of them and blend in, that I will do the same exercise like everybody else. And this was really important. But in the beginning, it was really hard. The one thing is like really unbelievably surprising to the middle-aged British gentleman when I come and take his hand. And he's just like, you know, reaction is like, what the hell you're doing? And, you know, what you want? and then, you know, once you build this trust, they just give you a hand, and it's so wonderful, and they give you, and they actually want you to do this. And I think that one of the success of this piece is that we all need it. We all need to don't have telephones. We all need to have not look at the watches. We all need to don't hear the sounds and to be with ourselves. But then let me tell you that one of my favorite example. So this was one guy, I just want to help his hand, and he said, nobody going to touch me. Don't touch me. So he ran out into this little, you know, locker room, and we drink the water. So I ran after him, and I said, I'm just curious, what is your profession? I'm a psychoanalyst. I said, I will never go to you. This is the last thing. But then, you know, then we sit and drink water, and I explain him everything. And then he went back and done everything, and then he came back again. But then, okay, this was a good example. There was another example. I have the hand, you know, another guy, and he literally, not only they didn't say anything, he ran to the water room, he ran to get his stuff out of the locker. And I ran after him again, you know, to try to understand what is happening. The man ran out of the gallery in a straight line, through the park, through the trees, through this. It's like you see a pure devil. It was incredible. I could not leave the gallery, so I could not do anything. And the most difficult example for me was this. There was a woman come with the husband and the son, and it was incredible. I never saw so much hate and so much. You know, she was like in a way aggressive, and she said, "This is ridiculous. What's this bullshit? Why are these people doing these things?" And I say, if we go to the, you know, water room, I can explain to you. He said, I don't want the explanation. I don't know anything for you. I think this is just nonsense. So she went to this locker room, and husband and son stayed because they wanted to experience. And I went to her because I wanted to, you know, to really, it's not to put her on my side, but explain. I at least have the at least the need or the freedom to tell her my point of story before she is also free to don't like it. That's all fine. But she was hateful. She was so hateful, and I was so unprepared to get all that hate on me that I started crying like crazy. I could not stop myself. I was like, I was so hurt because I come there with such an open heart and was like, wow, straight hate. And, you know, I could not believe how vulnerable I was. And then she said to me, you're not impressing me with tears. This is just horrible. Just let me alone. And she left. And God, I actually started being more careful. When I see the people who are not... who are kind of
unwilling,
I let them go. And what happened then? If you don't go to them and you don't do anything, they just see the rest of the people, which energy is so positive and so kind of changing the space, that after a while I look at them and they're still there, and after a while I look at them and they're doing everything without me telling anything. So it's like functioning by itself.
Were you fearful when you came up with this idea, which was bold, the idea of basically doing nothing, although in the end you've constructed some rooms, but basically it was just you in a white-walled gallery. Were you worried that the majority of the audience would react like that lady?
You know, it was a huge risk. First of all, I have to give up. I have to tell the Serpentine Gallery, it was amazing. To just, you know, when I told them, because we planned this show for so long, and we have a list of the walls we're going to show, and objects we're going to show, and video installations and so on. And then I was kind of not happy, because I didn't want to have in my curriculum another line in my biography, another museum show. Because, you know, when you have them, why you have so little time left. You have to do something radical, different, and to be curious, to experiment. And if you experiment, you can fail. And failing is part of the whole process. So I called, you know, just in January, I came back from Brazil to Hans Ulrich Obrist and Julia Payton Jones, and I said to them, you know, I really have this new idea. I hope you will like it. And she said, what's the idea? I said, nothing at all. We don't show anything. And, you know, they didn't question. I mean, if you ask this, any museum in the world, let's say Tate, I don't think they will do it. But never mind. but they will, I can't believe, you know, they say, let's go for it. Let's go for it. And, you know, you are here in a city whose art is such a commodity. I mean, we are talking about the city of Damien Hirst, which is, we are talking about diamond skulls. We are talking about young artists who are making whatever things for the Hermes leather, with the golden eggs, whatever. Everything is so expensive. And I say, okay, let's have IKEA chairs. That's really cheap. And then some camping beds, you know. Yeah. And then headphones.
The beds were crummy.
Literally, this show, I mean, we just use the props who are just for use. But, I mean, there was no material cost to make them, you know, in a special way. And then the most important, the expenses was for that show. It was really to put a human resource, you know, that we need 46 people. You know, because nobody can stay
helpers.
As long as I helpers,
yeah.
But they have to be trained. And I work with Lindsay Weisinger, which is a really wonderful person. We work in many different projects together, which we train these people. And the people have to be trained how to approach people, how to understand energy, how they can feel situation. Because it's so incredibly, you know, the fragile, the old thing, and to not just, you know, be ridiculous. And it's amazing. It's not. I can't believe.
This is a trick. I know you're going to hate this question, Marina, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. Is in that sort of situation, I mean, you're in such a vulnerable and powerful position, and then people do respond, and that must feel kind of amazing. Do you, at that moment, do you feel that this, you are an artist and this is an artwork, or does it feel something other than that? Does it feel like, in a way, you're a spiritual person, you know, communicating something other?
You know, during this show, honestly, I've been asking myself, I don't even know if I can call this art. I don't know what it is. I still don't know. I think that we create something energetically that I need so much more time to understand what really happened there. Because it's, you know, this kind of show, you can't be made without public. Public complete the work. All of you who've been there together actually make this work possible. And this is something, we kind of create another energetic the field, which was evident. I mean, people, you know, at the end of the day, everybody will come and stand around the platform or on the platform. And when you see that kind of luminosity on their faces and close eyes and really deep experience, which you can't deny. And we are in the middle of London, which is so full of destruction and noise and everything else. And this miracle happened. I think that definitely spiritual element. But in the same time, it's not just that. It's so much more complex. It's also reflecting our tiredness of consumption, of being junky consumptions, of goods, of time, of rushing, of telephone, of messages, of computers. We have enough of this. And I was just able to give them that island of absence of that thing.
And how do you feel? I mean, you know, we can see how other people feel, but what is it? How does it affect you and your own perception of yourself? Do you feel that you're some sort of spiritual leader, I guess, in that position?
I feel changed. You know, in my life, is not life change me, is my work change me. Because in my life, I always like to take easy ways, and I'm not interested in, you know, suffering. But then I put this huge, you know, condition to the work. I have to do this, and not this amount of hours. I have to walk the Chinese wall, takes 8 years. I have to, you know. Mm. And that process, and then in execution of the work really changed me, because I never give up. I can't give up. When you say no to me, it's just the beginning. I never, you know.
Yeah.
and then I see through this work I'm different. The one most important thing happened to me is, I have to share with you that, because it's just, you know, it's only 12 days how this finished. And, you know, I went back to home and I come back now and I can't believe I'm here today. I just, you know, came this morning. So, which I can say that, you know, I wanted to create this legacy, which was Institute of Immaterial Art. And I'm working with Rem Koolhaas, and we have the building, and we have to, you know, make this all this money to build this building, and we got Kickstarter running, and I'm just looking to this whole thing, and I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, after this piece, why I need building? Why I need to pay architects all this money? Why I have to do this? Because we can do it with nothing. Mm. We can create really immaterial structure who can be anywhere, anytime available to anybody of us. And that's so much more stronger, which we don't need to kind of have that building would become such a weight. It's become something that you have to carry and to take care of it. But this Serpentine show me that, you know, we can do everything with IKEA chairs, headphones, and some rice and lentils.
So basically, if anybody wants to buy a really large warehouse building in upstate New York, Marina's selling hers. By
I didn't announce, but more or less. And giving all the Kickstarter's money back too.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Because that's
a big turnaround. I mean, you were committed to that. As you say, Rem Koolhaas has done some designs for it. This was going to be...
And I spent so much money myself putting into this whole thing.
Yeah,
you know?
The facility.
But then, you know, what...
This Serpentine show suddenly showed you that this was...
No. We don't need anything. That's the whole thing, that we don't need anything. That actually being is the highest form of existence. We don't need anything. Mm. And I think that, you know, the people who really came there a few times or even once, that could feel that energy that they can access to in their own way, that we can, you know, create an immaterial platform that we can function in many ways, you know.
With that Serpentine show, you started off with the idea of doing nothing. And yep. Then you ended up with three quite distinct gallery spaces. Well, before that, you ended up with people had to wear headphones.
Headphones is always a must.
Yes. We'll understand that in a minute. And then the fact that then there were three very distinct spaces in which people were invited to act and react in certain ways. Why the headphones, and why those three distinct actions?
First of all, the Serpentine have three spaces that you have to deal with. Mm. And by the way, just a small detail, after I finished the show, Julia Payton-Jones gave me a present, and I could not believe. And she gave me a key of Serpentine Gallery, and I was thinking they're fake, so I went to try them. No, they're real. And then I was thinking, oh my God, now we have a little condominium in the park, good location. So there are three spaces. So you have to really deal with architecture. Well, so the first thing you enter, and locus are essential, that you leave your possessions. When you put the sound, when you put the headphones to block the sound, I love the Japanese. The Japanese, they always put the headphones and they say, doesn't work. I say, exactly, doesn't work. they say, this is not, you know, they always come in sound, something out of these headphones, but this is an absence of sound. So you put the headphones, and every single person that put the headphones, you create a certain zone. You're in different condition. And then, you know, there are all the different, which is incredible how it's orchestrated the public, because you have the ones who are just coming and observing. But then soon they want to experiment. Then they become observant, experiment. The new comes, they observe. Then the observant become, you know, the ones who are viewing again. So there is a constant changing the function of being observed and perform in the same time. So we are all in this on the same, you know, on the same level. And then, you know, the middle space, it was evident for me because of architecture, construction, the cupola and everything, that we create this platform. And this platform was, we just put in a certain shape. And then 3 days later came this woman from where she came from Peru. And she had this golden necklace, exactly in the same shape. And she said, oh, but this is from whatever Indians, very old symbol. It just happened, coincidence, that we have the kind of archetype images that was exactly shape in the middle. And then, so that always stayed there.
And was this like a decompression zone? Was that your idea? This is where people set themselves up and just got into the mood and the spirit of the piece.
But in the beginning, we changed also the central place many times to really find out that only energetically work if the people just stand with closed eyes in the middle and support each other energy. Because when you close your eyes... Oh, I just tell you, I love this story, that the shepherd, my shepherd story from Sardinia. It was in Sardinia, the shepherd, and every time I talked to him in the middle of the mountain, he closed his eyes. And every time he answered the question, I asked him again, he closed the eyes and answered the question. I said, but why always close your eyes? He said, but if I talk, I don't need to see. And it was so logical to me. So then, you know, if the moment you don't hear and you have closed eyes, you have two senses closed. So that everything else becomes much stronger. So that your sense of the feeling of energy of other people, feeling your own energy, and constitute yourself, it's incredible. People can start feeling blood, you know, the stream or the heart beating that normally never hear this kind of sound. So this is the place of that kind of concentration. Left and right rooms are changing all the time. Sometimes blindfolded, sometimes it's slow walking. Slow walking is a very important exercise.
Because?
It's because, see, slow, you know, first is active exercise, but at the same time is really about creating the certain state of mind. Because when you're walking normally, you know, you can walk slowly, easily, but your mind is like Ferrari, like a speed car. It's going on and on and on. But if you make repetition of the same gesture and walking very slowly, your body getting same amount of oxygen for a long period of time, that amount of oxygen, slow thinking process. And then you actually use slow motion and thinking process become the same. And that's a really incredible state of quietness that you would achieve. But you have to do repetition.
And that's, you know, that's knowledge you're displaying there about the human body and how we work.
But I don't need to tell anybody. If you just follow instructions and walk this room 7 times, 10 times, people... There was a great writer who come there every day, walk three hours the room and go right, because he just used serpentine like his own spiritual brain gym or the, you know, brain spa, whatever. And because when you do that repetition, you get through this knowledge automatically. So, you know, we always read the books and we always, you know, read the books, but we're not experiencing.
Yeah.
The idea is to experience. So it's one thing I'm telling you and then you observe and that's you don't know anything about. But if you're doing it, you're not just observer, but you actually doer. You are part of this process. Then you get it.
And the bedroom?
And the bedroom is another thing. You are alone, but with everybody else, which is very specific experience. And then again, you know, you close your eyes, you have headphones, you're in this very tranquil position, but somehow supported by other energy to get to that tranquil
state. It reminded
me
of a hospital.
Oh, hospital is great. I love, you know, I always like, you remember in our interview, I think they tell you the three my favorite institutions is prison, sanatorium, and the monastery. And because everything is very regular about, you know, physical experience and the mind can wander. But, you know, there is some bad sides. Monastery, no, this hospital is not good because you're sick. Prison is because it's no free will. But monastery is pretty good. Or now we create the gallery space like that.
Yeah, yeah. Marina told me a joke about monasteries before we came on. Which,
no, we don't go into this. It's really bad. It's a Vatican joke. I love it.
But, I'm gonna,
but if you tell it...
No way. And then before we just ask the audience to explore this work as well, one last question is what did you hope, expect, envisage people to take from this work?
You know, I have this very utopia, you know, desire. I always think that the only way to change the world is to change consciousness. And to change consciousness is on personal level. And it's so easy to criticize things how they are. I mean, look at it, just open television and it's a hell. But, and there is always, you know, criticize from outside. But what we can do on personal level. And to me, this whole thing with the serpentine is just a kind of possibility to use some tools I'm offering that work for me, and I hope you can work in your own life, and that's what I wanted to you know, to really give to people, that tools can bring to their own life. They can bring the tools that actually can bring them to the certain state of mind, who can change themselves, and that this, in that way also the you know, the world.
Okay.
It's cool. I'll tell you a rememberable Boltanski story I told you. I don't know if I told you that.
Remind us.
Boltanski, you know, is a French artist, and he worked always with childhood and, you know, the images. And I remember a long time ago, like 30 years ago, he was always, you know, he will keep his napkins when he was 3 years old, or the little socks, or, you know, things like that. And there was a big show of him in Venice Biennale. And I was there just listening to his interview. I was young. And there was a little vitrine with his little napkin and the little socks and the little cap. But he was, I don't know, 2 years or something. And the journalist, kind of very confused, asked, "And what you like to tell it with this work?" And he was very serious and looked at them and said, "Of course, to change the world."
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared. And to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the "must not take yourself too seriously" and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
So we all want to change the world.
Would anybody like to ask Marina a question about the Serpentine Show 512?
But also not to ask the question, to tell their own experience, which is to me even more valuable.
Yeah. Tell Marina your experience. That's a very good point. The gentleman there, I think.
Thank you, firstly, for the show. I'm curious about how you see your relationship with the rest of the art world. You talked about earlier this evening about immaterial. And yet, arguably, the art world now is more material than ever. Do you see yourself in the art world? Do you see yourself almost fighting against what much of the art world represents? Or do you, as I think you were suggesting earlier, see yourself almost outside the art world doing something very different around, for example, what you were describing, consciousness?
But, you know, I have to say that I work in the context of art world. So I am an artist working from that context. But, you know, thinking about historically, there is a lots of immaterial work from different artists which I really love, and it's a kind of, you know, family for me. And I think they're part of art world too. Like, one will be, I don't know, James C. Byers, another will be Yves Klein, Gino De Domenicis. They are really incredible artists who really work with that immateriality in their own way, and it was so difficult. I just give you the example of Yves Klein, the very important Yves Klein piece, made in 1956, when he on the bridge of the Seine sold to the collector the artist's sensibility. He said to him, he does sit standing on the bridge of Seine, and I said, "I'm selling you my artist's sensibility," which is how you can do this. And the collector said, "How much?" And he said a certain number, and collector take the check, write the check, and give to him. The Yves Klein take the match and burn the check, and all the ashes go to the river. And that's, you see, nothing happened there, but historically such an important thing is a mental transaction, or this incredible piece of Gino De Dominicis, who actually, you know, he was a very interesting artist who died, he suicided, I don't know, 10 years ago in Rome. And this piece he made that he actually, he sold to the collector invisible piece. And fine, the collector, it was a bar, it was late night, the collector was maybe you know, sorry for the artist who doesn't have no money, and, you know, he'd say how much, and he'd give him one sum. And he gave him a really nice check, and of course he didn't burn this time. He went and cashed next morning, and collector forgot all about. But 3 weeks later, there was a telephone call of the very respectful the transport company who told the collector they have invisible piece to deliver in his home. And then he will say, oh, my God, really interesting. So they was thinking joke. He said, okay, next Wednesday, 10 o'clock. Next Wednesday, 10 o'clock, the truck arrived. The six guys, gray suits, white gloves, very proper, you know, carrying the invisible piece. They bring to the home. And they ask where you can, we should put. And the guy say, I don't know, next to the window. No, 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 very sensitive to light. So they put it in the corner. And end of the story. But 4 years ago, there's a big, after he died, big retrospective of his work in Rome. And I went to see it, and I almost stepped on the invisible piece because the collector borrowed invisible piece to the show. And is it just a piece of tape around the white space? But you see, when you talk about these things, it looks funny, but at the same time, we are talking about immateriality. You know, energy. The performance is about energy, and it's about transmission of energy. And you can't describe, you can't touch it, you can't hang on the wall, but you can feel it. And this is the energy we're talking about. And this is still in a frame of art. That's how I see it.
But that's what just a gentleman's point. That's quite an interesting... Those stories were both great, but they were both involved the exchange of money, which was your point, I think, this fact that the whole thing's become very materialistic.
Okay, my other stories doesn't involve the money.
They're great stories, but it was interesting to observe that they both involved a transaction.
One is burn the check, okay, this is really destruction, and the other one, you know, it was survival.
Yeah.
Then that's true.
Yeah.
Then.
Okay.
Next?
Yes, gentleman here in the orange T-shirt. I think there's a microphone just coming to you. Can I just have a quick show of hands who would like to ask a question, so I get a sense of... And up in the galleries?
Oh, just somebody.
Okay, if you want to ask a question in the galleries, if you could just make your way to the microphone now, then we'll pick, over there, I think, we'll pick you up in a minute. Yeah, okay, the gentleman here, sorry.
Hi, Marina. I went to the 500... Oh, does it work?
Where? I was looking.
I went to the 512 hours, and it was an amazing experience. The experience was mind-blowing. You just can't express it in words, and just...
Why? Tell me for you, what was really for you important? What you took out of this for you? I really need to know.
Just being there, feeling everyone's sadness and happiness, just felt like changing your life, like not using so much technology and just slowing down your life.
What is your age?
14, and I'm...
Oh, my God, I love this. This, you see, it's for me...
And Marina, I last night written a letter for you. Could I please give it to you?
Of course.
Yeah, now, give to me, now. Actually, read it. No, read it.
Read it.
You want to read?
It's 11 pages.
What's the problem? We are long durational here.
Sorry.
We are long durational. Yeah. What is the thing?
Yeah.
Come, baby. You're 14. Wow.
If you could read it later.
I will read later, it looks like. Later. Thank you, baby.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good man, thank lovely. You. I know.
It's very, very protected. It's like completely closed with the staples. I will read later.
Oh, that's wonderful. I wanted to take one from the guy. You've got a hand there.
I just wanted to ask you whether you use your art tools as a sort of form of placebo sort of healing, a sort of ritualistic sort of healing, so that people self-heal by being part of your art tools and embracing that. And you're sort of facilitating them to,
you know, I
use
think
that as a form of placebo.
You know, I didn't really realize this before, but more and more I feel that there's this kind of aspect is also part of it. It's not only, but it's this kind of aspect. Already in a house with artists is present, I have this, you know, something happened to me there already in the performance and continue to happening when I perform and when I'm there with the public, I have this, I can't explain, but this unbelievable opening of my heart that is like almost painfully giving love unconditionally to total strangers. And that is something that people really could feel and they kind of get open to me. You know, and this is the healing, that kind of emotions, because we are so, in many ways, selfish and so kind of shy and self-conscious and we don't look at each other's eyes and we don't hold each other and we don't, you know, share things. And the social society is more and more alienating these feelings. So when you have that possibility, people really go for it. And I think we need it. We need it so badly, that outburst of pure emotions. And I know when I have, you know, one critic in New York, he's a friend of mine, and he said, "I hate your work. I hate it so much." I said, "Why?" He said, "It always makes me cry. I can't stand it." because you know, we are so used to take everything intellectually, and every art have to be an explanation, and you understand at a theoretical level. But my work have to hit you in the stomach. It have to be something very pure, and then you think about it, what happened. But that feeling have to be there. And I really, that heals too, you know, that have to happen. That emotions are so important. The people cry, you know, cry is, it's so important to cry, because otherwise you hold all that inside of you, but just kind of get it out. I received one email, but I mean the letter from somebody saying that he came many times to Serpentine and he had a cancer, and then after 1 month he went to check the doctor and he doesn't have cancer anymore. I mean, this is too much. This is
some placebo.
We are turning to Lourdes. That's no. It's like, but it was like, you know.
But Marina, you said about the show that it was a risk. It was and risks can fail. And it's really to the that lady's question. Have you ever made a piece which involved interacting with the public, where, in your own terms, it's failed?
I didn't interact with the public this way. This is like, you know, my last maybe 15 years, and it's different. But before, I would make the pieces for the public. And I never tried the piece, because performance you don't try. This is not a theater. And if you try, you'll never do it, because you understand how difficult it is. So you just do it when public is there, and that's it. And I was performing one piece, I don't tell you the name, but never mind. I was performing one piece and in the middle of it, I understood this is so bad. Oh my God, this is the worst thing I've ever done. And I could not stop. Public is there. I am there, so I can tell them now, sorry, forget it. This is really bad. So I went through the whole thing. It was terrible. I had the temperature that evening. I was sick. I was physically was
what was,
so sick.
What was wrong about the
everything.
Concept?
It was just everything was wrong. It was like, you know, I was presuming something would work and just didn't. And there's
because you didn't feel it, or
it's like it was artificial. I wanted too much from the things. It was not my own. I didn't put enough my feelings. You know, the moment, this is the old thing. The biggest fear I had about this piece, it was not about the public. The biggest fear I had, it was about me. That in the process I will stop to believe that this is possible. The moment I stopped to believe it's possible, everything fails, because you can feel from me. But that was the most important. This was the most scary me, because I was dealing with something I could not touch. Mm. That we are arriving, all these people in the space, and something's happening that is invisible, but touch everybody. Mm. And if I trust that, if I don't trust it will happen every time, then we are
Anything other than total commitment.
That would be really, you know,
disaster.
Everybody feel. You know, the public is incredibly sensitive. When you're in the front of the public and you're performing, you can stand in the front of the public and perform. But in your mind, you can be in Honolulu or wherever, whatever, Hong Kong, I don't know where. Public know that. But if your mind and the body is in the place at the same time and that energy dialogue is happening, then it's real. And it's same with public. You have to take that attention and then it's... You know, it's the chemistry between two. It's not just one way.
How do you prepare to get yourself into that mental and physical state?
A lot. You know, a little bit of story of my life. With, you know, living with Aborigine 1 year in the west of Lake of Disappointment because there was never water there. Going to Chavance in Australia, in Brazil. Look, you know, study.
So you bring all that history.
Fires, everything. I was interested in everything where you can rationally explain what's going on with the body and mind. To understand the other sides, really. Like study Tummo exercise. Tummo exercise is wonderful Tibetan exercise when you can visualize fire in your solar plexus and you sit.
Fire?
And you sit naked in the snow, on, I don't know, minus 20 degrees, and you can rise the temperature any part of your body. The monks doing, the Tibetan monks doing for fun, they put the students bring the towels, wet towels, absolutely ice cold, they put on their shoulders, to the masters, and masters dry the towel, just steam comes up. We can do these things. We just use technology for everything. We are invalids because technology replaces all our abilities. Yeah. Telepathy is so much cheaper than telephone. I mean,
Has somebody up on the upper tier got to the microphone and got a question?
Gentleman just down here.
I'm not a gentleman.
Oh, so I'm difficult. No, it's okay. Marina and I, it's a lot of lights. It's gorgeous woman. Sorry.
Marina, I didn't attend the exhibition, and I'm very sorry about that, because I feel it has been fascinating, or was fascinating. But my question is, you seem to rely a lot in your work, for what I heard anyway, on silence. And we're here in the Royal College of Music. And I just wanted to ask you a question about sound. And I think a lot of our mind and our experience and our energy can be expressed in sound as well, in my opinion anyway. I just want to hear your opinion about sound, and maybe sometime you will use that in your work.
You know, I always said that, you know, when we create invisible pyramid, you know, like kind of in our mind of the hierarchy of art, I will put the sound on the top, absolutely the music on the top, because the music is absolutely... the most immaterial form of art that exists. It's that you don't need object between receiver and the one who is doing it. It's just direct energy dialogue, and incredibly important because it goes through your body right away. And there is so many, you know, cultures that understand that, and you know, like just the simple Tibetan bowls, you know, they have healing property because the Tibetan bowls are made from the 9 different metals. Each metal creates one vibration, so that, and they can create, you know, this certain impact on your nervous system, and you can really work with sound in such amazing ways. I think sound is absolutely important. A part of this, you know, in my institute also, we are very much connected to young scientists. And like in this mutual gaze in Artists is Present, we, you know, I've been kind of interested, everybody got interested in me, the American scientists and Russian, because I was the best guinea pig. Nobody sit, you know, 3 months motionless on the chair just to experiment, but I was doing that. So they put the AG caps and really the measure my brain waves and to see what is happening on the scientific level. That would be great.
You did amazing stuff, Marina. But that is very much... cutting-edge 21st century stuff. Your career started in the 20th century. You were born, 1946, in Serbia. And you said you, 6 or 7, you were a painter. And you had your first exhibition when you were 12.
Jaluz and Mozart.
Child is a monster. And your parents were you, it's a strange upbringing. Your dad was a... what is he, a general in the army, in Tito's army, and your mother was
major.
You didn't like her, right?
Major.
She was a major, and she was a major pain in the ass as well, right?
No comments, but she's dead. It's good. So any comment? What is the question?
The question... Well, this is a bit of background that people didn't know, really. But your... It seems to me that that relationship you had specifically... I mean, your parents were intellectuals, really, and you grew up at a strange time in the sort of history of Europe, and you had a very strange relationship with your parents, most specifically your mother, because they divorced. And that, and I suppose to get a sense, just going way back, how that, all that informed your decision to become an artist and then to find performance as a way to express yourself.
Wow. So the theory, my theory generally is like this. The more fucked up childhood you have, the better artist you become, because you have material to work. You have so much more material to work with. And the histories are full of, you know, bad, bad childhoods around. So, you know, in from any point of view, I had actually a good childhood because I came from privileged background, you know, like everybody was, you know, we was not poor, we was actually like, you know, red communist rich in a way. I had the piano lessons, I had the English teacher, a French teacher, I had the, you know, we had the maid at home and all these things, you know, which...
Very bourgeois.
Which very, very bourgeois, because communists are bourgeois. And you know, all these things. But at the same time, I didn't have love, and I was very
lonely.
You
didn't have love?
No. My mother never kissed me in my life. And once I asked her, but why you never kissed me? I was 35. She said to me, what? I mean, I don't want to spoil you, of course. I mean, it was totally normal. And she said, my mother never kissed me either. So this goes generational, you know. And really crippled me so much. But at the same time, as you see now, I generate all this love to everything else, you know, I'm doing. And this is, you know, my public become my family.
How did your parents respond to your idea in what was a conservative communist environment that you were going to become an artist?
But, you know, my mother was in the beginning very supportive because, first of all, she was art historian. She ran Museum of Art and Revolution, which was horror for me because it was like, you know, partisans around the fire next to the tanks and the Kalashnikovs. So that was the museum. And then, you know, she could take modern art not after Warhol. Warhol was already a scandal for her. And in the beginning, I was a painter, and I was young, and I was painting my dreams, and I'm painting flowers, and I'm painting all this stuff. I used to, for the old relatives, paint these horrible flower paintings just to give me money. And then I was always signing huge, like, I'm so ashamed of this now. I was always looking Picasso signs, so big Picasso. So I was signing with blue paint, Marina. And my mother, actually, later on in her age, she bought all these paintings back. And she have them because she thinks that was the only time when I was a real artist. So now I really think, and now I have them, I'm thinking of burning them seriously because that's really bad. But a part of this, it's it was hard. It was very hard to, the moment when I understood that I don't want to paint anymore, that's when the all hell starts. When I was painting, I even have my studio.
What triggered that decision?
Is this really beautiful little incident that I was, you know, painting. In that time, I was painting clouds, and I have this whole different series of clouds. Clouds who are coming, projections, black holes, clouds who are attacking the human beings, whatever. So I was always looking to clouds. And I remember lying on the field in the park, and I look up the sky, and there was no one cloud in the sky, just blue sky. And I was just waiting for cloud. And then out of nowhere came, you know, 11 military planes like this high, you know, the ultrasonic, and they just made a whoom and made this incredible drawing in the sky, which is amazing. I just looked this drawing and how this drawing was formed and how disappear and how the blue sky stays there. And this was like almost spiritual revelation for me. I stood up and I said, I don't want to go back to studio and make something two-dimensional. But I can use everything. I can use aeroplanes, I can use fire, I can use the water, I can use the body, I can use anything. So I went straight to military base and asked for this, you know, 11 military planes if I can make the drawing. And they called my father, you know, and they say, your daughter, get her out of here, she's crazy. You know how much cost to do that? So this was project not realized. Then I have this... then I got this another idea, it was even more better. So I was thinking, okay, if I put the sound, the big speakers on the bridge, in the main bridge of in Belgrade, with the sound of bridge falling down. So you're on the bridge, and your red sound, bridge stop existing, but visually the bridge is still there. So I have to, of course, ask, you know, City Hall for permission. So I went there, and they told me, architects, they say, but you know what, with the sound, bridge really can fall. So it was no. So there was another no. And so, and then I made it in my own building, but was very short living because everybody ran out thinking the bombing. So there was not really, really out. But now, which is interesting now, talking about Lisa Shaw again, because it's early war.
This is early days, yeah.
It's that I have this piece called Freeing the Horizon, because I was so suffocated. I want to have a free horizon. So I had this old postcards of Belgrade, which I was just painting buildings away. And there was just kind of just plain white horizon standing, and I could, you know, breathe again. It was, you know, virtual. And then 30 years later, the Belgrade was bombed, and some of these buildings really don't exist. So it was like almost voodoo in a certain way. And then I have another sound installation. We was having this student cultural center. We would just go there, you know, to wait for to go to the cinema.
And it was easy to be an avant-garde artist at the time.
It was beautiful. It was good days, actually.
Good days?
Yeah.
Because something to push against?
You know, it was just different. It was nothing to do with money. You don't even think that you'll ever live from this, what you're doing. But then, you know, that piece called Aeroport I like, because that was this big hall that we drink coffee all day long and, you know, go to theater, do things, discuss about art and everything else. And then I put this sound, a very sexy, cold voice saying, you know, all the passengers of the Yugoslav airline yacht can go immediately to gate 343. But we had only three gates, but I like this kind of ritual. 343, the plane is leaving to Hong Kong, Honolulu, and Bangkok, or something like that. And then every 3 minutes, you have these incredible passengers immaterial going to this trip. It was never going to happen because we didn't have money. We could not leave. But with the sound, talking about sound, you actually can do, you know, you can go anything. So all these unrealized projects, you see, and then I have to leave.
You have to leave because you can't grow there, or you've been told to leave.
No, it was a huge conflict with the mother, with my things. You know, why I have to leave. You know, then I actually done lots of performance work in those days in ex-Yugoslavia, and then there was the gallery of the museum, but it was, you know, they decided to show some of my photographs. And I made a show, but my mother, I always have to come back 10 o'clock in the night, even if I was 29. So I have made all my performances before 10 in the evenings, because 10 I have to be home. So there was big opening, and everybody was, you know, celebrating my opening, went to the dinner. But before 10, I come home. So I come home, and it's dark, and I say, oh, my God, this is fine. You know, everything is okay. And I opened the dining room, and I see my mother sitting full. She always had a double breast suit, very much Margaret Thatcher, that's exactly like, and with the big brooch here. And she completely in the dark. And in the meantime, somebody called her from the museum and say, your daughter is hanging naked on the wall. This was it. She was waiting for me to kill me. That was the story. And then, you know, I came, and she looked at me, you know, when I put the light on, and she take this ashtray of this huge crystal ashtray from the unhappy marriage, whatever, it was all mess, it was standing on the wall, it was really ugly and kitschy. She take this ashtray, and there was this wonderful Taras Bulba, you know, the text from the Russian writer saying she just used the sita, she said, I give you the life and I'm going to take you. So she take this ashtray and throw on my head. So the ashtray is flying on my head, and I'm thinking, or towards my head, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to move the head. She's going to splash my brain on the wall, but she's going to prison. She's going to suffer. She's going to... And then I move, and then I left Yugoslavia.
Very good. Fantastic.
Oh.
Just to spin through, Marina leaves Yugoslavia. She comes to the Edinburgh Festival, actually, in 71, I think. Then becomes a postman in Britain. Can you believe that? Marina Abramovich, a postman.
Oh, can I tell the postman story?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so now I'm out of Yugoslavia with a group of Serbian artists. We don't have penny. We don't have anything. I have to do some jobs. So the friends of mine say to me, but there is this job. You can just deliver the post in the night. So they give me really ugly British post uniform, too small, little short skirt, you know how it is. So I'm going to, I hardly speak English, and it was so complicated, all the streets that I have to go out to find out. So I work for almost like months, and 3 in the morning, I'm still delivering the post, you know, putting around. So then I one day I was so tired, and I make this very radical decision. And I say, this was, you know, not computer time, this was, you know, the typewriter machine. So I say, every letter who is a typewriter must be bills, some ugly news, and something, you know, something from the government, I just throw it away. And everything was written by hand. It's a love, it's emotional, it's a family. I deliver. And then I was doing like this for 3 weeks, and that was a mess. But nobody could prove anything except they asked me to return the post uniform back.
So, and that's the postman. It's a great story, isn't it? I wanted to ask you about a specific work, Marina, because it is just so extraordinary in its concept and its delivery. I mean, a lot of your earlier works, less so now, a lot of your early works were put you in a vulnerable position. They're also sort of quite violent, involved cutting yourself and endangering yourself, but nothing quite like Rhythm O. And I just wanted to understand, really, why you wanted to make Rhythm O at that point in your career, and what it did, and how it affected what you did thereafter.
So can you explain to the public Rhythm O?
No, you're the artist.
But come on, do something. I've been talking so much. Explain, and I tell you why.
Okay, Rhythm O is a work that Marina did in 1974.
Exactly.
And it involved her standing on a stage, not dissimilar to this, with a table.
No stage, just the gallery.
Oh, here we go, you see.
No, this just a small detail, that's all.
So it's a gallery, table.
Stage means theatre, we're not going stage.
Okay. There's a table with, I think, 72 objects on it of varying types.
Yes.
There's some flowers, there's some silk, there's a gun, there's a bullet, there's a knife. These things are all laying out on the table. Marina is then standing, I think, at this stage by the table, an audience just like there is here, I think standing as well. And then I think the work is triggered by Marina asking for people to interact with everything they see about her, and that's that. That's how it starts. And people began quite politely, maybe to come and touch your shoulder, or they'd pick up an object and... I think maybe somebody brushed you with a rose or something like that. And then, over a period of time, it developed into something much, much darker.
Oh, okay, small detail. I didn't tell to anybody anything. It was just like a menu on the table saying, I'm an object, do whatever you want with me, and I'm taking all responsibility, including killing me.
That's a big detail.
One bullet only. So, and the pistol. You have to put the bullet into the pistol. But you also have the things to for pleasure. You don't need to use aggressive things. So I had both ways, you know, pleasure and pain. But this experience, this was, we are talking 74.
Which country did you first put?
Naples, Italy. Mm-hmm. I was so angry. I was so angry on the art scene. You know, being a performance artist in the 70s was a very hard thing to do. And the public was constantly, you know, criticizing us that we are masochists, that we are sadists, that we're just about the pain, that it's all ridiculous. And they're calling this, you know, there was no art. There could not be anything to do with art. So this performance for me was design. What if I'm doing nothing at all? What I'm just motionless? With all the objects there as a possibility, and see what public can do. What is responsibility to public, to the performance artist? And on the end of that story, I knew the public can kill me. And this was a really very strong experience, because the public in the beginning, again, was long durational, because I took 6 hours. 6 hours is a very important time, because in the beginning, public was playing, they give you, you know, they comb your hair, they give you rose. Then they come somebody and cut your clothes and take the rose and put the pins in your body. Then they take the knife and still have the scarf. They cut me here and drink my blood. Then the one put the cotton and start lighting the cigarette. Then another one put the water on you. Then another one, people are holding me and putting me on the table and open my legs and put a knife in between.
And you're naked at this stage?
Yes. Yeah. And then the interesting thing is a normal public who come to the normal opening. And what's the most interesting thing that... that what they project in Italy on me, imagery, was Madonna, mother, and the whore. Mm. There was the three images. Mm. And the only way I was not raped there, because they came with their wives. So and then there's another interesting thing, was that actually a woman was telling the men what to do, and they never did. They would take my tears away with the handkerchiefs, very elegantly. So when the 6 hours...
The women were more aggressive?
No, they were just telling men what to do. Uh-huh. And then was very interesting, another story, that on the 6 hours was finished, you know, I was full of blood, I was like half naked, it was a mess. And then the gallery said to me, 6 hours is finished. I start walking towards the public, because whatever they do with me, I accept it. You put my hand out, I stay in this position, always facing one point. And just to be absolute object, and to see how far they can go. And of course, including killing, somebody put the bullet in the pistol, give me the pistol, and open the trigger and see if you know, how I react. I didn't react. And then he started pulling slowly my hand. And then the other person came, lost his nerves, started fight. It was in the bullet went to the floor, and things like that. And then finally, after 6 hours, the others came and said, this is over time. So that my time of performance is over. So I start walking towards the public. They just ran away. Literally, they all ran away. It was incredible. I was just alone. And I remember it was like 2 a.m. And I go to the hotel and I look myself in the mirror and I had a big piece of gray hair. Since then I painted. I don't like gray hair.
You got rid of it. Why did you want to make rhythm? What did you want to...
Just to show that actually it's not. It's the public can kill you. That's right. To see that actually... And you see how interesting the Rhythm Zero is about that, the yeah. negativity part of the public. But then I made Artist is Present, where I completely create positive...
Does everybody know about Artist is Present, the show that Marina did in Manhattan Museum of Modern Art, where in 2010 she sat at a table in the big atrium there in a rather elegant dress on a chair.
716 hours, this one.
Yeah, exactly. And there was another chair with nobody in it on the other side. And Marina sat there all day, every day, for nearly 3 months. And people could come and sit there. And they couldn't interact, smile or laugh or talk. They just sit there and commune, really. And I'd spoken to the people at MoMA before the show, and nobody knew. It was the first time, actually, a performance retrospective had been held. Nobody knew how it was going to go, but expectations were unbelievably low. They were, weren't they? And it turned out to be one of the most successful shows that's ever been held at MoMA in its entire history.
850,000 people.
Extraordinary. Nearly a million people came.
But what is incredible in this piece, it was that I understood that it's so easy to put human spirit down. And what we have to do...
So easy to do?
To put the human spirit down. Mm-hmm. It's about how we can create, how we can change that, how we can put human spirit up. Uh-huh. So like this Serpentine piece, like that MoMA show, it was about that. And, you know, yes, you can put a knife, you can put the pistols. You actually wake up the wars. But what if you don't? What if you just ask them to slow walk? That's different, or headphones. So I'm not into this. It was a process for me that I needed to do all these very radical, very difficult, painful pieces to get to that point. Every work is actually leading me to this piece of Serpentine.
On that note.
Okay. Wow, we finished. Wow. And I'm getting my letter. Thank you.